This is The Full Story. I'm Tom Kuser. Today we're taking a look at affordable housing in Connecticut, or the lack of it. This week, Governor Ned Lamont announced that nearly $50 million in state funds will go to develop hundreds of affordable housing units in communities throughout the state. The city of New Haven is in that group. It's struggled for years to expand its stock of affordable housing, but advocates are not giving up. WSHU reporters Davis Donovan and Janice Roman have been investigating efforts to develop more affordable housing in New Haven, and they join us now on Zoom. Janice, hello and welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. Davis, hello to you too, and thanks for taking time today.
Thanks for having us, Tom.
Sure. First of all, maybe we could define affordable housing. When we say affordable housing, what are we talking about? And does this include renting, buying a home, or both?
Well, it can include a lot of things, renting and buying a home, both. But the definition, if you're going across the entire country, of affordable housing, according to HUD, Housing and Urban Development, is 30% of your income. So how much are you spending, you know, all told, just to stay in your current housing situation? And across Connecticut, that number can vary pretty widely. In New Haven, where we were looking, it's about 30%. That might seem low, but that's significantly higher than what a lot of towns around the state offer. And I should say that's 30% of people who are at minimum wage. So obviously, housing can be much more affordable for people at higher incomes. But when you're working at minimum wage, and, you know, of course, obviously, this can be more challenging for single parents, there's not a lot of housing that's available for you in Connecticut.
So it sounds like there are a number of variables that figure into the equation, so to speak, when we talk about affordable housing, based on what you're saying. It depends on your income. It depends on the kind of housing that you may be working with. It depends on where you live. What part of the state? Is it a city? Is it rural? Is it the suburbs? Do I have that right, Janice? Maybe you could talk a bit about that.
Right. From what we've seen in our research, the affordable housing, or the term affordable, has been defined in many different ways. I think that depending on not only the area, or not only the city or the town where the housing is located, but even breaking it down to something much smaller, as in different sections within the city. For example, in New Haven, there are different areas within the city that vary in terms of what can be considered affordable based on New Haven's median income. From what we looked into, the city had gathered an affordable housing task force to actually do research and look at what can be defined affordable within, specifically in New Haven. And what they found was that affordable rent can be considered something close to $750 a month, or maybe fewer. And sometimes that's not something that can be found within the city. So it really varies depending on which area in the city we're talking about here.
You begin the report that you put together, the story that you produced on this topic, with New Haven resident Kevin McCarthy. Can you tell me why you started with him in this story?
Kevin McCarthy is a resident in New Haven, and we decided to speak with him, or begin the story with him, because he's been in New Haven for more than 30 years. So he's seen throughout the decades how policies have been implemented, how things have changed or haven't changed. And so it was something that was important to begin the story with that perspective. He's also a co-chair with the East Rock Community Management Team, which if you look at the city, it's sort of divided into different areas, and East Rock is a certain area within New Haven. And he sort of gave that perspective of what he had seen throughout the years and different policies that were implemented, some that worked and some that didn't work, and depending on the different area within the city.
Let's listen to the first couple of minutes of your feature report, which will be airing soon on WSHU.
Kevin McCarthy has lived in New Haven for more than 30 years. He's seen the city propose solutions like subsidies and penalties on landlords to increase affordable housing. But many residents are still burdened by rent that costs a third of their paycheck, often much more.
New Haven really is two cities. It is a wonderful city if you're doing okay financially or if you're associated with Yale. It's also a city where there's a great deal of poverty.
McCarthy is with the East Rock Community Management Team. He says in the past few years, the city's had a housing boom, but the majority of the units built are market rate.
When we've had developers come in, one of the questions that routinely gets asked is, are you going to have any affordable housing? And the answer almost universally is no.
McCarthy says the housing that is created is not affordable to someone that's working class.
If you're a single person working a minimum wage job, you can afford a rent of about $600 a month. Places like that don't exist in New Haven.
2 years ago, the city's Affordable Housing Task Force put out a list of 44 recommendations. Among the recommendations, expand zoning laws to allow new forms of housing, like rooming houses and accessory dwellings. McCarthy calls them granny flats. Enforce penalties on landlords who don't maintain housing quality standards. Karen DuBois-Walton is the head of the city's housing authority, and she was part of that task force. She says the idea is to give people their housing of choice.
Our goal is that when you drive through our communities, things don't stick out to you as that must be where the poor people live. But we are creating things that are high quality, that families feel valued when they live there.
DuBois-Walton says just 30% of New Haven's housing qualifies as affordable. That's still good for Connecticut. The state's had some of the least affordable housing in the country for years, especially for renters.
That's far more than you find in any of our surrounding towns. And it's a very similar pattern that you'll find if you visit Hartford or Bridgeport. The cities have the bulk of the affordable housing concentrated in a few neighborhoods. And the surrounding towns really offer very little in terms of opportunity for families.
We've been listening to the first couple of minutes of the investigative report that Davis Donovan and Janice Roman have put together, looking at affordable housing in New Haven. Also in your story, following this section, you talk about a controversial idea to change zoning laws in some cities and towns in order to spread more affordable housing opportunities out across the state. Where did that idea come from?
So a lot of these ideas have been proposed, especially recently, by a group called Desegregate CT. Their founder is Sarah Bronin. If that last name sounds familiar, she's the wife of Luke Bronin, the mayor of Hartford. And this group has been trying to call attention to some of what they see as historically unfair and historically prejudiced zoning laws that especially small towns in Connecticut have had in place, maybe sometimes for decades. One example of that that you may have heard about is in Woodbridge, where only something like 2% of housing in Woodbridge could be considered affordable. So Desegregate CT has been trying to get a lot of momentum behind some of these ideas. One of them is to require a certain amount of affordable housing within range of public transportation and commercial centers. Now, obviously, not every small town in Connecticut has public transportation, but this would open up a lot for developers to build more affordable housing in small towns. Some of the residents of those small towns are unhappy about this because they say it's going to bring in developers. One term that you hear a lot that's a very controversial word is character. They say it could change the character of these towns. Well, people in a lot of the advocates in these small towns say the character is what makes the town what it is. Some groups, including Desegregate CT, call attention to that word, saying, well, does that have racial undertones? Say the character of a town, could that be implying something about the type of people who might live in this town? So it's become a real firestorm, including leading to one public meeting that went, no kidding, for almost exactly 24 hours a couple of weeks ago. I can't think of another public hearing I've seen go quite that long in recent memory.
And again, before we talk a little bit about that, I guess you'd call it a marathon hearing, to put into context what you were just talking about, affordable housing in, you mentioned Woodbridge and there are other towns, the problem being for those who have lower incomes, the cost to live in those towns, the housing, be it rental or home owned, you know, ownership type situations, it's so high that there's just no way someone with a lower income would be able to spend just 30% of their income and be able to live in those towns, correct?
Right. It's prohibitive. And I think that's the key word here. Now, you know, we looked at New Haven, but when you take the difference between New Haven and elsewhere, say in the surrounding towns around New Haven, like Woodbridge, it's the difference between hard and impossible, right? I mean, we heard Janice mention that figure in the 600, 700 range, and you would never find that in a town like Woodbridge. That just doesn't exist.
You mentioned the marathon, 24-hour marathon meeting a moment ago. Obviously, the controversial ideas toward of changing zoning in towns to accommodate more affordable housing for various reasons drew quite a bit of attention. And is that why the marathon meeting became a marathon? Is that why it lasted 24 hours? There were just so many people who wanted to speak?
Right. I think something like 300 people were on the docket for that, which, by the way, I'm pretty sure 24 hours is longer than most actual marathons. Yeah. And there was a lot from advocates like Sarah Bronin, I mentioned before, but also a lot of people from these small towns saying, well, this isn't going to do anything to help with the historic racial inequity. That's one thing you heard a lot, but it's just going to make it easier for developers to build in these towns. One argument you heard a lot was, well, this would take away the power of local planning and zoning boards to turn down ideas and put that power in the hands of the state.
So that hearing was before the General Assembly's Planning and Development Committee, correct?
Right.
Does the bill, and I know it's just in the hearing stage and hasn't moved too far from there, does the bill have any momentum that you can detect?
Well, it is getting out of the hearing stage. I think it does have momentum. I expect this isn't the last we'll hear about this.
I would imagine along the way, as you were researching this story, you must have run into more than a couple of ideas that proponents thought would resolve the affordable housing situation. Did any of those ideas seem to have some traction without too much controversy?
Well, I spoke with a Jonathan Wharton, who is a professor at Southern Connecticut State University, but formerly he had worked with the City Plan Commission in New Haven for, I believe, it was about 4 years. Before he had left the commission, something that he told me he was looking into was the idea of vocational housing, which is something that would be a specific area of housing that is specific, I guess, for both different vocations. So teachers, housing, things for public safety, like firefighters, policemen, and whatnot. And this would be in addition to income-based housing as well.
And is that kind of housing, does that exist somewhere currently?
Well, from what he told me, he had seen those types of housing models when he lived in Jersey City and North, where he had worked on various planning commissions within those cities in the past.
You mentioned that the 44 ideas that were brought to the table in New Haven ideas to expand affordable housing in the city and the area came about, I believe, in 2019, pre-pandemic. Has the pandemic changed perspectives on affordable housing from what you've been able to detect in your reporting?
I think it's been pretty clear that the pandemic has affected not just housing, but many areas within the city. Lots of plans and initiatives that began in 2019 sort of had to be put on pause with the pandemic. Only recently, as earlier this year, did the city go back to addressing some of the recommendations that was listed on the report that was given by the Affordable Housing Task Force, one of which was to create an inclusionary zoning commission. The inclusionary zoning initiative looked at ways to come up with additional affordable housing units, and that is something that recently was started up again earlier this year because of the pandemic. They sort of had to hit pause on that. And I think that because of pandemic, it sort of in a way highlighted all of these disparities and the need for affordable housing within the city. So if anything, I think it allowed the topic of affordable housing to be more centered within this sort of this spotlight.
I think it's also worth mentioning how much the pandemic just took everything to raised the stakes, right? Took everything to a new level. We've seen a year of eviction moratoriums and moratoriums on utility shutoffs, right? I mean, I think we're all aware of what an eviction during the pandemic could mean. We really don't want to see homelessness increasing in the state right now. And everybody's, you know, landlords are aware of this. And I think politicians are aware of it too. It's a time that's just put a lot more stress on especially those and lower income levels have really disproportionately felt financial burdens in the past year.
Davis Donovan and Janice Roman, thanks so much for your reporting on this topic. Janice Roman and Davis Donovan, WSHU reporters, looking at affordable housing in New Haven and in the region. Janice's and Davis's report is part of a partnership with the Solutions Journalism Network. You can listen to it on our website, WSHU.org. In my conversation with Davis and Janice about efforts to make housing in New Haven more affordable, you may have heard the name Jonathan Wharton mentioned. Well, Professor Wharton is Associate Dean at the School of Graduate and Professional Studies at Southern Connecticut State University, and he was a member of the New Haven City Plan Commission. And he joins us now via Skype. Dean Wharton, welcome back to The Full Story.
Thanks so much for having me on.
When did you serve on the commission in New Haven?
My term actually ended last spring, so I think it was March, if I remember correctly.
And what were the affordable housing issues that the commission dealt with during your tenure?
Well, there were some concerns, and rightfully so, about pathways for developers and investors to consider building complexes, especially apartment complexes, not so much condominiums or houses in particular, that would be slated for a specific number reserved based on income. So typically the set asides would be anywhere from maybe 10 to 30% of units, for example, that would be income based. And usually that sliding scale would be somewhere around, let's say, it would actually be kind of middle class income. It would usually be anywhere from $30,000 to $50,000, for example. Mm-hmm. And so that was very popular, especially in the downtown core.
I'd like to talk too about the Affordable Housing Task Force report released, I believe in 2019, so just prior to the pandemic, 44 recommendations in that report to address New Haven's shortage of affordable housing units. Just some of the items in that very long list: creating a permanent affordable housing commission, funding an inclusionary zoning feasibility study, lobbying the state to allow municipal housing authorities to create low-income housing outside the city, increasing awareness of city-owned vacant lots, creating an inventory of privately owned vacant lots, and the list goes on. And most of those had to do with creating affordable housing within the city. It's quite a list. And we're going to talk about ideas for outside the city. And we hear calls to expand those opportunities right now, as a matter of fact, with efforts to pass a state law that would go in that direction. We'll be doing a whole show, a whole program on that in just a couple of weeks. But I don't think generally we hear a whole lot, at least outside city limits, much about ideas that are focused inside the city. Are there opportunities there?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, this is going to be an emphasis of mine. I'm overdue to write for my next column for Connecticut News Junkie, which hopefully will be out by next week. Connecticut could really look at other states and see how they do it. Of course, we're kind of limited because certainly home rule is certainly in vogue and will remain in vogue for a long time. But states can be very creative, for example, even the tri-state area. I studied a lot, for instance, especially my dissertation on New Jersey, for example. Not only are they doing the kind of housing and development that has become very popular in the Northeast, like transit-oriented development, where you build around existing train or bus station hubs so people can be more mobile and get around. You could also consider something that I'm a big advocate for, vocational housing. That's been talked about here and there, but you don't see it in full force as you do in places like Newark, for example, even Jersey City, where public safety officials or employees and teachers, for instance, would get some kind of reduced housing costs. And that could be, by the way, rentals, condominium ownership, or even even buying houses. There are all kinds of incentives that developers and investors and the state and grants and even the federal government can kick in to help out with these kinds of incentives. So unfortunately, a lot of this gets lost in the fight on both sides of how affordable housing is seen as kind of a sinful thing to discuss about, especially in the suburbs. But in truth, you could find all kinds of innovative approaches to counter, you know, back to configuring communities, both in suburban and urban areas, that could be more intuitive to populations that want to remain in affordable housing options.
According to the report, the 2019 report, 41% of all households in New Haven are what would be considered housing burden, meaning these individuals and families are paying more than 30% of their household income toward rent and utilities. Is there a way to address that problem when it comes to income, or does it make more sense to stick with let's create the housing and then worry about the income as a separate issue?
Well, traditionally, a place like New Haven has done it for years, and I've never been against it, and other cities have as well, where you get investors or developers to consider, you know, a certain percentage of housing specifically based on income. You're using a 30% metric, but recently, let's say in the last 10 years especially, many investors and developers are actually looking closer to 40% of income based on housing, because the assumption is, especially in cities, you may not be so car reliant, and so the expenses on cars aren't necessarily there. It's kind of interesting, actually, in New York, especially in Westchester County and other areas where they are really more reliant on public transit than they are here, you see this take shape. Especially for younger people who want a car share, for example, that's really popular in a lot of urban areas. We probably don't have maybe a robust car sharing program that we could really have compared to other places, or even more bike sharing options. But there are other ways and other expenses that can go towards housing as opposed to, things like on transit, for instance. And one thing we can't ignore in this is kind of a big topic of mine are food deserts. You know, if you have grocery stores or places where people can shop that are right nearby, and unfortunately, we're not very good with that in urban areas in Connecticut. Again, I studied this in New Jersey, especially in Jersey City and Newark. It actually allows people to walk or be nearby a grocery store. Typically, 5-6 block ring is considered kind of doable. And I'm looking for that in projects like around downtown North and the project there in Hartford, for example, around the baseball stadium. That could even be plausible. That's been, for example, on the table for years. But We're really behind in these areas, unfortunately.
With the vocational housing idea, you mentioned housing that's built with walking distance to shopping, for instance, in mind. With vocational housing, is that a situation where, in this case, teachers? I understand Hartford has one of those developments. Live near where they teach, so that transportation isn't quite such a problem.
Exactly. And it's not nearly as much of a cost burden. And so you're right. Hartford, I know that they've been examining this and pursuing it, and seems as though they're going to be ahead of the curve of other cities. But I was fascinated, for example, of Newark. My research indicated an example of what they did in Newark, what they called a teacher's village. And they had investors from Goldman Sachs and all these major banks coming in, grants and money and investors to do that. You know, too often we think of these big banks and Goldman Sachs and these others that they're doing all these investments and hedge funds and whatever. But if you see banks and institutions doing more of this to build out communities, you can really lead towards some tremendous turnaround in a lot of areas. I should also say they also have a Whole Foods downtown as well that they had built along that. So that helped, right? That's the big chicken or the egg. You know, do you get the grocery stores, the retail, the conveniences of the city first, or do you, you know, allow for vocational housing or apartments to go in next? So it's good to kind of plan that out to be as inclusive as possible on both sides. And that's been a big emphasis of my research.
We talk about home rule. You mentioned it, 169 towns and cities in Connecticut, all with their own ideas about things. If we focus on the cities for just a moment, the handful of large cities where much of the affordable housing is concentrated these days, are the cities much different from one another? Can ideas that work in Hartford work in New Haven or in Waterbury or in New London?
It really depends. I mean, for example, here in New Haven, we have 30-something board and commissions. And so think about all these boards and commissions, let alone the Board of Alders and the mayor's approval to get a project done. It is a lot of bureaucracy and red tape. And I have to share with Tom, you know, and your listeners, it's been frustrating to hear that from lawyers over the years that I was a commissioner in New Haven. We had to find a pathway that works. And the mayor admitted this publicly. Mayor Elliker said this. When he ran for office, he wanted to find a better pathway of getting this organized. You know, I've been more intrigued if this helps as an example of Stamford, right? Stamford is very innovative with their zoning and their planning. They're constantly changing and evolving, their empty spaces and land. I'm certain that your listeners are familiar with, especially in Fairfield County there, with Harbor Point as an example, right? Where the investors and the developers came in, they were able to reconfigure the area tremendously, and it's just booming now. And it'd be great to see other possibilities like this beyond just Stamford. But Stamford, they've been one of those cities where they're terribly innovative. I'm amazed. I wish more research could be done on it. I'm probably overdue to focus more of my studies in that direction because I think we have a lot to learn from them.
Does the creation of affordable housing in cities run the risk of also creating areas of gentrification?
Always. That was a concern that came up frequently in New Haven. But I would counter, as I said publicly several times, New Haven's unique because it's a lot more of a population that is more reliant on mezzanets, right? It's more based on educators and certainly those involved with the hospital, right? We all know that, Yale-New Haven Hospital and Yale University are the two largest employers in the city. So it's not that corporate outfit, for example, like in Stamford. So you're dealing with a different population. You're not dealing with a population where in gentrification, they are oftentimes more reliant on income that is more of a disposable income, where they're spending more money on services and on food and that kind of thing. And so they have more of a buffer for rent. So I oftentimes stress at the meetings was more of a studentification. Professors have called it this in the past, that we see among educators, graduate students, and even undergrads. And so they're not only having the kind of flush income that you're thinking of when it comes to gentrification, but in corporate places like, Stamford, that is a constant concern. I don't want to also ignore a place like Fairfield Metro around that train station, right? There's been concerns about that and some of the development that's been going on that side of Fairfield near Bridgeport. So you should always be concerned about what that could lead to in terms of gentrification, where people could be easily priced out.
And what about the people at the lowest end of the economic scale, the lowest end of the income scale? They could be very easily pushed out of a development, I would think, called affordable, even when gentrification has been pretty much, put aside.
Absolutely. Some cities are very innovative of what they can do to help them out with that. Beyond some of the grants to help them out with the housing costs, they could also assist maybe as well as something like in job training so that maybe they could be considered for promotion or finding another job, for instance. So you see some cities and some states finding alternatives to getting people to have a higher income, for example, so they can have affordable housing options for them and beyond even where they currently live.
Another question that's related to the pandemic, really. Has that changed the way affordable housing is thought about today? These 44 ideas that were put forth by the task force back in 2019, pre-pandemic, may have had some ideas that are pretty much outdated just a year and a half later. What's the pandemic done to the thinking about affordable housing in the cities?
It's delayed it in a lot of ways because, you know, it took a while for the meetings to take place. And it was kind of interesting because I was cycling up the commission, for example, and there were all these concerns about how to even organize and have the meetings, you know, take place, especially virtually and online. So you had this delay period back last spring. And so there was a backlog. And there were already a lot of plans, proposals, even before the pandemic happened. So, you know, this guy, again, that kind of goes back to that factor of how can you better streamline some of these projects to really come online. And with the pandemic now, especially where it's delaying projects, it's a concern and it will be a long time concern. As far as the housing demands, especially of so many New Yorkers and people leaving these bigger cities like New York and Boston, and they're coming to Connecticut, we already know there's a housing crunch. No doubt about it. I was reading a series of articles just this week about how, for example, my hometown of West Hartford, where I grew up, you're seeing bidding wars now, where it's going up 10-20% as it relates to even buying a house. So this is going to be a concern because of certainly the migration patterns that we're seeing in the tri-state area. And it's something I've actually been paying special attention to. What can you do to deal with that? Well, that's just market demand right now. I think that this should be really a wake-up call for developers and investors to realize that, hey, this is a housing demand, this is a housing crunch, and we need to build out and do more developments. And I hope that our public officials recognize the greater need for this, too.
Professor Wharton, are you optimistic about efforts to increase the amount of affordable housing in the cities? Are we closer to an answer than we were a year ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago?
Yes and no. This is a constant question my students bring up with me in my urban development classes. And, you know, part of it for them that they're concerned with is it's too costly to live in this state. And so many of them want to live here. They'd love to just not be at home or live from home. They, you know, with their parents, they would rather like to if rent on their own or at the very least consider buying a place in the next 5 years. But for many of them, and these are even older students, even graduate students who are 25, 30 years old, it's unaffordable. And so that is going to be an ongoing issue, I think, for a while. And that's some unfortunate news. I think if there's any good news is that, you know, you are seeing some projects coming online, like we spoke about with Teachers Village, for example, in Hartford. You are seeing transit-oriented development taking place around New Haven, where as a commissioner, I helped vote and support the project going around State Street train station to develop and designate an area that's specific to that kind of development. And so I hope that we can see more projects like this. The problem in Connecticut, though, is it's not so much we're traditional or old school. We're hesitant towards change. And I know we're, you know, the beloved land of steady habits. I respect and appreciate that. I mean, I am a native son. But we should find ways of really fast-tracking some of these projects and get more projects off the ground. And it doesn't always have to be in cities. I brought out a fascinating discussion point at University of New Haven, for example, West Haven. They have a terrific train station. I even used it yesterday. First time I actually got on Metro North in almost a year, believe it or not. And it's a beautiful train station. Yet you go around there and you have all these abandoned warehouses. And then you have all this singular zoning taking place. And the students there, when I gave the lecture a couple of years ago, would love to see more development in an area around there. But then you get the resistance of not in my backyard syndrome, where not everyone is on board with something like that, unfortunately. But we have to find a pathway of communicating and finding a way of getting projects like that, you know, off the ground.
Dean Wharton, thanks so much for your time today. We appreciate your insights.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity.
Jonathan Wharton is Associate Dean at the School of Graduate and Professional Studies at Southern Connecticut State University. This is The Full Story. I'm Tom Kuser. One way to help ease the affordable housing crisis that's come up in our discussion today is vocational housing. The RBH Group, a company based in Newark, New Jersey, is focused on expanding vocational housing all over the country. And joining us now is one of the founding partners of RBH, Ron Bate. Mr. Bate, welcome to The Full Story.
Hello. Good to be here.
I guess we should start with a definition. It's something I was not familiar with until recently. What is vocational housing?
So it generally refers to housing that's within a certain range of affordability. And generally, you'll see different definitions, but it ranges usually between 80% and 120% of the area median income. So in other words, units that are affordable to those that earn between 80 and 120% of the area median income is sort of the definition of art.
So when we put the word vocational in connection with the word housing, are we talking about certain specific vocations? Are we talking about, in your case, I guess we're talking about teachers specifically, right?
That's right. Yeah. So when we think about who earns those kinds of wages, we're really talking about the vocations. We're talking about police, fire, teachers, and many other vocations. Quite frankly, the majority of this country, when you think about area median income. And that's why it's so crucial to be working and focused and building this product, because we focused a lot as a nation on luxury housing and, quite frankly, have had significant and productive programs for affordable housing. But the majority of this country has not had the opportunities to partake in that.
Where did the idea for vocational housing come from?
We used to think about it all the time because it was a necessity for corporations, insurance companies, big business that needed to provide housing so that they could attract the human capital that they needed and the human resources that they needed to run their business. And so we used to build a lot of it, but stopped doing so when that source, you know, stopped financing the project. And then, you know, sort of have not had the capital markets to do it since. And recently, we've been thinking a lot about it because, for example, here in Newark, New Jersey, where we incubated the idea of Teachers Village, the first one, we saw that in this neighborhood, we had been building affordable housing. We had not had luxury housing built in Newark. Our Newark Teachers Village was the first ground-up project in the downtown in 40 or 50 years on the residential side. But we noticed that this project, we were looking for where the demand sources are. And when you looked at the demand sources, teachers who are coming into Newark already 6 days a week, for example, we realized that, you know, they're really who we should be building for. And for different reasons, various reasons, there just hasn't been anything built for them. And so I think recently we started thinking about it because there's a lot of demand for housing at these price points. And in a lot of markets, either they make too much money to qualify for the affordable housing and not enough money to be able to afford the luxury housing we've been building.
And with a development like Teachers Villages, in the case of Newark, and I'd like to ask you, too, about the development in Hartford here in Connecticut. This allows the people that you're focusing on, the teachers, to live closer to where they work, possibly even within walking distance?
Absolutely. And, you know, we became fixated. Not only does it provide, you know, quality housing near where they work, which really, when we think about sort of the advancement of quality of life when you live near where you work, right, we talk about it a lot in urban areas and urban contexts. You know, the sort of flip side of the coin, when teachers can't live near where they work, it's very difficult for the teacher in terms of a quality of life. So great advancements in quality of life. But beyond that, what we started finding is an advantage and a value add for the teachers and the community, where you have a cluster of teachers that live together, sharing ideas, exchanging ideas, socializing with one another. And we really think that beyond sort of the easy connections to advancement and quality of life and the easy connection to be able to recruit and retain the best teachers in the region to the neighborhood, we think that there's going to be innovation in education by just merely clustering teachers. So, yeah, a lot of advantages when you start thinking about vocational housing and workforce housing for a community.
You have to be a teacher then to live in this community?
So we target, you don't. Not exclusively. We aim to have at least 70% educators and paraprofessionals in our community. So the other folks that work in the district, in the school district. And so We aim to have about 70%, but we do always have at least 30% for other professionals in the community. So it is open to everyone.
How big is the Newark development? How many individuals, families are living there?
So it's 204 residential units with about a little over 300 people living there.
Is it full then? Is it fully occupied pretty much?
It is, yes. Great success leasing these units. And even through COVID, had maintained really high occupancies.
So it's worked the way you expected then?
In a lot of ways, it actually exceeded our expectations. Again, Newark was the first ground-up residential building in 40, 50 years in the downtown here. And we were leasing the buildings even before the construction was completed, which is unusual for rental product. And quite frankly, same thing in Hartford. We leased up very quickly. And what we're seeing is that these projects take a lot of partnerships, both on the private side and the public side, which is to say you're doing significant community outreach when you bring these projects to a community. And that work really inures to our benefit when we deliver the product. You know, people are waiting anxiously for the project. They know about the project. They feel like they've contributed to the project in some way. In so many ways, they're waiting for this product to come. And we've been delighted with how we've been received. And really, quite frankly, in Newark and in Hartford, we've had a very similar experience. And now we're bringing the project to many other jurisdictions.
I'm speaking with Ron Bate, the one of the founding partners of the RBH Group, a company based in Newark that's focused on expanding vocational housing throughout the country. You mentioned, and we both mentioned, the Hartford Teachers Village. Could you talk a little bit about that, how that came to pass? It's on Asylum Avenue in Hartford, I believe.
Yeah, you know, that one, we were brought in by the Prudential Insurance, who has a big presence here in Newark, New Jersey, has been a great partner of ours over the years. And Prudential has a big presence in Hartford and their social investment group. And they were working with Roseanne Haggerty at Community Solutions in Hartford. And the community specifically had done a lot of affordable housing and in the downtown wanted a workforce housing product. And so Prudential introduced us to Roseanne. And so this building that sat idle on that corner of Asylum and High, across from Bushnell Park, sat idle, I think, for at least two decades. And we were brought in, and I have to tell you, Connecticut, it has an amazing process to be able to create this kinds of projects. There was the CHAMPS competition, which is four state agencies get together, CHAFA, DOH, CRDA, and the Department of Environmental Protection. They all get together, they view applications, and they work together to be able to finance these types of projects. So we came into Hartford with Prudential and then introduced to this process, and quickly we were awarded by this consortium of state agencies, and they agreed on the financing plan, and so we were able to execute. And so a real tribute to public-private partnerships. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that the Goldman Sachs Urban Investment Group was also a partner of ours on this. And, this is how you get this stuff done.
You mentioned the building in which the Hartford Teachers Village is now located. The property was empty for 10, 20 years. And I understand those are defined as development zones. Do you target development zones for projects like this?
We do. So the public investments work from the federal level really chase distressed census tracts. And so a lot of the products that you would use to build this kind of project work best in those distressed census tracts. Those distressed census tracts became what a lot of people know now as the opportunity zones. So opportunity zones are a subsect of distressed census tracts. So they're not all the distressed census tracts, but they're a subset of the distressed census tracts. And opportunity zones is something that people are starting to become aware of. And so for us, it's an easy way to sort of circle and say, oh, if this is designated opportunity zone, we know that we can get a lot of the public investments we need to make these projects happen. So we pretty much exclusively focus on those neighborhoods.
How do the developments, the Teachers Villages developments, affect the neighborhoods where they're built, the surrounding areas? Are the areas largely like the vacant building in which the Hartford development is located, or are there others living nearby? I'm wondering how it affects those who are perhaps already living nearby. Can they stay where they are? Are they forced to leave? Is gentrification a problem?
Yeah, the answer is, in short, no. I mean, the inherent affordability of this product allows people to stay, right? I mean, the problem when we talk gentrification is usually that a neighborhood improves such that the people living there can no longer afford it. Mm. By creating this type of vocational housing and affordable housing, you are by definition providing opportunities to stay and live in the community. But more than that, Teachers Village, New York, for example, it was built on what was 91% surface parking lot. So clearly improving and creating a neighborhood, actually not recreating or redeveloping a neighborhood that had really fallen into disrepair. And the truth is, we're already working hard on these financings with, the various government agencies and private entities. And so we're very focused on design too. So we make sure that we have quality designs. And so when you think about delivering quality designs at an affordable price in either building that laid idle for two decades or a neighborhood that was idle for for several decades, you really are redeveloping the neighborhood in a way that we should be thinking about this stuff across the country. I think our Chicago project is another good example. The Chicago Public Schools was shuttering a school in a neighborhood that had been there, a school that had been in the neighborhood for generations. And we came into the community and repurposed that school to provide just that. So a school would not sit idle. And if there's no need for educational classroom, well, at least let there be housing for teachers. And so I think in so many ways, the quality, the affordability of it, and just really the nature of the locations we select, they really are value added to a neighborhood.
Are you considering, is your company considering any projects that would create affordable homes that, in your case, teachers could actually buy, help expand affordable home ownership?
We are actually, yeah. In the Chicago project I mentioned, a second phase will include some for sale housing, and we are thinking about it in other jurisdictions.
Are there any more villages, either ownership or rental unit villages in the works for Connecticut or New York?
No. We'd love to consider other opportunities in Connecticut. New York has been a little bit more difficult in terms of the cost structures there and, quite frankly, the public investment arena, which it's really hard to access. They do a lot of it, but generally has been reserved for larger developers than us. And so New York's been really tough for us to sort of break into, at least New York City. But Connecticut, we'd love to do other projects, and New Jersey has a great public investment arena. And so we'd love to do more stuff. We just haven't. We are working in Atlanta, and just this morning received our approvals from the public finance arm in Atlanta, Invest Atlanta. And we're working in multiple other jurisdictions, but really responding to opportunities at this point.
Has the pandemic changed the way that you think about vocational housing and the work you do?
It has in it's only sort of reinforced our belief on how much more we need to do in this space. And the conversation nationally, I think, has shifted in a way that will facilitate the execution of these types of projects. But in another way, in our Atlanta project, for example, we'll really focus the same macroeconomics that we saw that brought teachers back to the center of the community, where we wanted to create more affordable workforce housing, vocational housing for teachers, has led us to also realize and explore and verify that there's actually significant demand similarly from seniors and for seniors. And so bringing seniors back to the center of urban communities, we've done a lot of work in this country on senior housing in the suburbs. And again, a lot of luxury senior housing, a lot of deep affordable senior housing. But again, that middle market has not been explored and built for, and certainly not in the urban cores. And so we've become fixated on the need for a middle market senior product that would be more independent, so not nursing facilities. We're not focused on assisted living or memory care, but really independent living with a suite and a sort of a la carte menu of healthcare products that can be brought in from a healthcare provider outside, but that really we became fixated on the intergenerational relationship that we can have between the seniors in our communities and the teachers in our communities. I mean, the real vision that we sort of pivoted during COVID was that, wow, we really need, how great would it be if our seniors could teach our teachers in a community that's at the center of the community? And so, you know, our Teachers Village concept has evolved into Teachers Village Plus over the COVID period. And now we're thinking about seniors and thinking about other members of the community that can add to our community, if you will.
Would you ever consider plans to create affordable housing for vocations other than teachers?
Absolutely. And that's why, you know, when we aim to have about 70% teachers, we have about 30% other professionals. You know, when you think about a municipality, or there are significantly, usually depends on the municipality, but significantly usually more teachers than there are fire and police and other civil servants, but it's all necessary. It's all needed. We'd absolutely consider doing more of it. So, you know, we're absolutely open and, you know, with open arms to have all of them. And so, so we are currently open, and I wouldn't be surprised if sometime in the future that there's sort of other products we deliver exclusively for those folks.
Mr. Bate, thank you so much for taking time to explain vocational housing to us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much for your time and listening.
Ron Bate is one of the founding partners of the RBH Group, a company based in Newark, New Jersey, that's focused on expanding vocational housing throughout the country. How would you resolve the affordable housing shortage in Connecticut? Let us know. You can email us at tfs@wshu.org, and we're on Twitter as well, @FullStoryWSHU. And that's our program for today, produced by Fatu Sangare and senior producer Ann Lopez. I'm Tom Kuser. Thank you for listening to The Full Story.